One of the hallmarks of Jewish law is the integration of ethics with law. You study the codes of Jewish law, the Shulchan Aruch, other sources, and you're struck by the fact that what other systems might call ethics are interwoven, really inseparable from Jewish law. Modern world, you know, we have laws that regulate the medical profession, and then we have medical ethics. We have laws that regulate the legal profession, and we have legal ethics, which are beyond the law. Experts in Jewish law have pointed out that it's kind of a hallmark of Jewish law in that ethics and law are deeply interwoven. They really form one continuous whole. We're going to discuss today some basic perspectives on Jewish ethics. From one perspective, everything in Jewish law is really an ethical question, but we're going to be discussing ethics as they're commonly understood, ethics as they relate to moral dilemmas where you need to weigh one person's life or health or well-being against another's, your own or third parties. How do you make these decisions? On what principles do you use? What rules do we apply to solve these types of moral dilemmas? In the modern world, they've created all kinds of mostly academic theories of ethics. They give them all kinds of names: utilitarianism, consequentialism, deontological ethics, and so on. And utilitarianism further can be broken down into act-based utilitarianism, rule-based utilitarianism. Just in summary, most of these theories are largely of significance to the professional ethicist. People who write and study academic ethics have all kinds of elaborate systems. Most people in the real world act on the basis of some kind of intuitive combination of these rules. We act based on a religious tradition, based on a moral tradition, based on social conventions. Very few people, I think, are obsessed with the exact formulations of these ethical theories beyond those who study them, those who are professional ethicists. But just briefly, to summarize some of the basic trends and to kind of give us a backdrop for discussing Jewish law perspective on these matters, you basically have utilitarianism against everything else. Utilitarianism, going back to Jeremy Bentham, sometimes called consequentialism or related to consequentialism, is a very simple idea. It's seductive in its simplicity. It's simply the idea that the morality of an act is measured by its outcome. Consequentialism, as in consequences, we decide what I should do based on, let's consider the consequences of various courses of action. Let's decide, using some metric, which consequences are better. Obviously, we can weigh consequences different ways, but assuming you have some way of measuring the utility, they call it, fancy word, meaning the goodness or the well-being, happiness, whatever it is, as Jeremy Bentham said, the greatest good to the greatest number, that's utilitarianism, and you simply take the course of action which we expect it to yield the greatest good for the greatest number, or however you measure whatever metric you use for your consequences, that is pretty much utilitarianism and consequentialism. Opposed to that, there are a whole slew of other schools of thought, deontological ethics, rule-based ethics, other types of systems which say it's not so simple. There are other factors beyond simply tallying up accountant-like the maximum good and making decisions. There are rules, there are other values that get taken into account. Everything else pretty much falls into this everything else category of how you make these decisions. And as we're going to show, halacha certainly would fall, Jewish law certainly falls into the everything else category. The main moral dilemmas we'll be discussing today are classic examples of cases where a consequentialist, a utilitarian, will arrive likely at very different conclusions than we will under Jewish law. And the truth is, utilitarianism, consequentialism can be refined and modified, and they talk about strong rule-based utilitarianism, weak rule-based utilitarianism. Again, you can refine and modify, and at the end of the day, you can pretty much cast any moral argument within one of these different schools of thought, but just roughly speaking, when we're not going to be discussing academic ethics, roughly speaking, the point that we're going to show is that in Jewish law, it's very much not the case that we simply weigh the consequences, weigh the outcomes, and decide which is preferable. There's a whole slew of other considerations, of other methods by which we make our decisions, which are not simply based on maximizing good. So let's consider first the trolley problem. The trolley problem was a 20th century thought experiment, basically, academic kind of artificial problem posed by a British philosopher, Philippa Foot. She was actually discussing Catholic doctrines of double effect and abortion questions. Double effect will be familiar to those who have studied Talmud as something similar to the notion of ena miskaven and psik resha. Basically, the idea that intentionality counts in evaluating what is a moral act. A pure utilitarian will simply say If the person's dead, it doesn't matter if you aim for him, if he was an unfortunate, today they call it collateral damage, it doesn't matter, dead is dead. When you calculate whether bombing a certain building is moral, you might kill some innocents. It doesn't matter what you want to do, it doesn't matter if you're a terrorist trying to kill them or not. If we're deciding whether it's moral, you simply look at what is the expected outcome. Innocence, guilty, however you measure the value of this, good or not good, we don't care what you wanted, we don't care what you thought, we don't care what would make you feel better, it doesn't matter, we simply look at the outcome. In halacha, in Jewish law, of course, it's not so simple. We do look at intention. You can deliberately intending something gives the act a very different character than not deliberately intending it, even if you can expect the outcome to happen. That's called a psik resha, an unwanted, sometimes unintended consequence, and it has a very different status under Jewish law. So Foote was discussing similar questions in Catholic theology and related moral frameworks, and she posed the trolley problem. The trolley problem, the question many of us, in England apparently they call things trolleys. We would probably say train or truck, but they have different words sometimes across the pond. They call it a trolley. So the trolley basically is a runaway train, we'll call it, hurtling down the tracks. It is hurtling toward five people who are all going to be killed by the impact of this trolley. You have one action that you can take. It's a contrived situation. Again, you can think out of the box and think of other things you would do if it were a movie to save everyone else and find some clever solution. But for the purpose of this academic exercise, it is a binary choice. You have one and only one option. You can pull a switch, which will divert the train onto another track, which unfortunately has one other person. Person number six is standing on the other track. You will kill him. If you do nothing, that's your other option. The train kills the first five people. Is it ethical? What is the ethical thing to do? You pull the switch, kill one person who otherwise would have lived, and that's the price you need to pay for saving the original five. So again, a pure utilitarian, simple-minded utilitarian would say, assuming everyone's life is valued equally, five against one, five is five times more than one, pull the switch, and that maximizes the general welfare of humanity. Foote considers variations of the problem. One of them is called, perhaps not so politically correct, the fat man version of the problem. Instead of pulling a switch to divert the train, you're standing on a bridge, the train is going under the bridge, about to hit five people. The only way you can stop the train is by pushing somebody, a large corpulent fellow, over the bridge, so he will stop the train, he will die, and the other five will live. Again, from a purely consequentialist perspective, it's pretty much the same question. But again, from the systems that we're familiar with, from Jewish law, from other systems, people feel very differently about this question. You're actually killing somebody. You're not just diverting a train, which is a neutral actor, from track A to track B. You're actually taking someone and throwing him in front of a train. So she discusses these questions. So the trolley problem, or variations of it, are actually discussed in Jewish literature. Most famously, there is a 20th century discussion of this by the Chazon Ish, Rabbi Avraham Yeshaya Karelitz, a leading Israeli scholar of the mid-20th century. He talks about a slightly different version. In his case, there is an arrow. Again, we might think of it as grenades sometimes, but there's an arrow heading toward a group of five people. It's going to kill all of them. Again, the only course of action available to you besides doing nothing is to divert the arrow, and the only course toward which you can divert it is one that will kill person number six. The Chazon Ish actually discusses whether that is the right thing to do or not. And again, the analysis he uses, he takes for granted that we are not simple, pure consequentialists, and he goes back and forth on the question of whether this is the appropriate thing to do or not. To consider the Talmudic background behind this, the main source discussion, which yields all this, which is the main locus for this discussion, which actually is applied in practical ways by authorities throughout the ages, there is a discussion in the Mishnah, the Talmud, the codes of Jewish law from 2,000 years ago. The case they deal with is someone approaches a group of people. The enemy approaches a group of people and says, turn over to us one of your number, and if not, we shall massacre the entire group. So in this case, it's not even five against one. They're all going to die regardless. Assuming you trust the enemy, they're not bluffing or anything. Assuming, again, we stipulate that their threats are credible, they have the intent and the means to implement their threats. So do you turn over one to save the group? And even here, the Talmud is, even though he's going to die anyway, Rabbi J. David Bleich explains the issue is you can at least prolong his life by a few minutes if you don't turn him over. Maybe everyone will die in an hour. If you turn him over, he'll die right away. Regardless, the Talmud nevertheless says it is not a simple matter to turn over one to save the others. It is generally actually forbidden. The only time it is permitted, the Talmud says, is if they single him out, yichaduhu, yes, if they single him out, and it gives an example of Sheva ben Bichri. Sheva ben Bichri was a biblical figure. He was a rebel against the rule of King David. When King David's forces, military forces, hunted him down, he holed up in a city, and Yoav, King David's general, was threatening to basically eradicate the city and to destroy the rebel. So the city treated with Yoav. They told him, what do you want? You want him? We'll give you his head. They killed him. They threw his head out. And true to his word, Yoav relieved the city of the siege. The Talmud says, in such a case, where they ask for someone like Sheva ben Bichri, and they say, we want him, or if not, we're going to destroy all of you, then you can turn him over. The problem with all analogies, of course, is that we have to understand what is the key property of Sheva ben Bichri that allowed him to be turned over. Yes?
Well, I'm confused as to what the difference between that situation, Sheva ben Bichri, and the other situations you gave, where in the other situation where you've got five, and just give us the one, and we'll...
Well, the original cases I discussed, if you divert the train or the arrow, a new one will be killed who otherwise wouldn't have died.
Right.
In our case, they're going to massacre the city and kill everyone, including Sheva ben Bichri, so he's dead either way. There's no question he's going to die. They're going to wipe everyone out.
So is the hypo that you set up not Sheva ben Bichri distinguishes just either six people among your group?
Well, we'll get to a little further. We'll explain more as we go.
Thank you.
So Sheva ben Bichri is the one exception, and here we have a major dispute in the Talmud and the Mishneh, the Braisa even, the Talmud itself, about what is the requirement of Sheva ben Bichri to allow this kind of behavior. Some say it is enough that they singled out one, that the enemy has their eye on one specific person. Innocence or guilt doesn't matter. Innocence or guilt does not matter. As long as they've said, we want him, you can turn over the one they've designated. Others say, no, it is only because Sheva ben Bichri actually is liable under Jewish law, maybe under non-Jewish law, is liable as a rebel against the king, least majesty, he is guilty of liable for the death penalty either way. So he anyway is, his blood is forfeit, so you can turn him over. The difference, of course, is in many real-world cases where the enemy singles out one person they want, but he's not guilty, he's innocent of any crime, they just want him either because they're immoral or because they think he's guilty but he isn't or something like that, can you turn him over if the consequences are losing everything? This, unfortunately, as I said before, has come up more than once in Jewish history. One of the most widely discussed cases was about 400 years ago in a responsum written by Rabbi Yoel Sirkis, the Bach. His case involves what we would call today desecration of the host. When we talk about atrocities committed against us by Christians, and most of us are familiar with the blood libel, but a close second in terms of sheer bloody-mindedness was the charge of desecration of the host. The Christians, apparently, the Catholics, had rituals about the bread and the wine, where the Jesus would be reincarnated in the bread and wine and so on. And Jews were frequently accused of desecrating the host, of stealing the host, this piece of bread, this wafer, they call it, and then first stealing it and then sticking pins in it. And why on earth any rational person would think that we had nothing better to do as downtrodden minorities in Christian countries who knew that their lives and properties were forfeit if they were accused of something like this would have any interest in stealing wafers and sticking pins in them, I have no idea. But it would be funny if not for the fact that so many thousands of Jews lost their lives in pogroms and massacres as a reaction to these accusations. Apparently this stuff kind of faded away in the 17th and 18th centuries. This case of Rabbi Sirkis would have been one of the last last cases of such an accusation. Not quite the last, unfortunately. So in his case, there was a Jew who was accused of desecrating the host. They already killed one of the Jews involved. And then there was another Jew who was suspected of having been complicit in the crime. And he had hidden. He had run. And he was not available to the Christian authorities. So they simply, no problem, they were big on collective punishment back then. They simply rounded up the communal leaders, and they said, we are going to inflict punishment upon all of you unless you produce the guilty one. I don't know if they thought they were actually guilty of harboring him, or they just simply applied pressure as the most effective means of trying to get him to turn up. The question was, could they actually force him, turn him in to the Christians, to let him suffer the consequences of this desecration of the host rather than let the whole communal leadership or much of the community suffer. And Rabbi Sirkis, after a detailed and intricate argument, basically concludes that it depends. He, as many other authorities do, it's actually surprisingly unclear in the original Talmudic discussion which way we rule. Do we rule you can turn over anybody who they want or only someone who is actually guilty? Many authorities rule that you can only turn over people who are actually guilty. However, they also take a somewhat broad and liberal interpretation of what does guilty mean. They say he does not have to be guilty of a crime under Jewish law. It is sufficient that he be guilty of a crime under a legitimate and fair sovereign authority. So if this Jew was indeed guilty of desecration of the host, of stealing it, and of whatever they accused him of, then he indeed can be turned over to face the consequences of his actions. If he is not guilty, if it's a trumped-up charge, if it's unfair, then he cannot be turned over, and his ruling essentially hinges on this question of whether it can be established to our satisfaction that he is guilty of this crime. So even though, of course, from a Jewish law perspective, desecration of the host is certainly not a capital offense, but that doesn't matter. It is sufficient that under a local system of law, they consider this legitimate. If he actually did it, then he's liable. We can turn him over. It's not exactly clear if they would have massacred the whole city or the leaders, whether they would have found him or not, as in the Shevman Bichri case, or whether it's more like the Trolley case, where they're turning over one man to save five. But either way, he seems to rule that the question hinges largely on whether he is guilty under, again, their system of law of what they're accusing him of. If he is guilty, he can be turned over. If he is not guilty, then he cannot.
How do you determine if he's guilty or not? I mean, they're not going before the, for instance, Christian courts or anything like that.
That's a good question. I don't want to get too deeply into that because, you know, the rules of evidence in cases like this are tricky. I don't remember if he has a detailed explanation or he just leaves it to their judgment as to whether they think that the facts clearly. But you're right. Obviously, in any real world case, evidence and process are important. But yeah, I'm just avoiding that.
And it's the communal leaders who would make that determination.
The Bach was addressing the local Jewish community. Who exactly would make it? Also, an important question of process. I'm just not sure, so I'm gonna just avoid that for now. It's an important question. Certainly, an important question, though.
You know that the decision. When the Hazanish did this? Because the reason is actually there were numerous cases like this during the Holocaust. I know of two in Vilna, where the Germans said, "Look, there's some underground leader. You get him, you produce him for us, he's hiding somewhere, or we will kill a lot of people." Of course, they eventually killed a lot of people anyhow. But that was, and what in the cases that I know of, the question was decided not by the community, but by the person involved who made the decision to quote, turn himself in after being convinced.
Right.
But I'm not quite sure how that fits with the Chazanish, but it fits chronologically with them.
Okay. So we'll turn in a moment to some other Holocaust cases. There is a related discussion that also this goes back several hundred years, although it has obviously applications in the Holocaust. There is a related discussion, again, dealing with collective punishment on the part of the authorities. This begins really in practical response. So this begins in the 16th century. There are Yosef ibn Lev in Sephardic Turkey. There was a draft. I don't know if it was a military draft, a forced labor draft of some sort. The government was drafting people to do its business. Not a pleasant job. Not something, I don't know if they paid, but like jury duty today, or they didn't pay anything. It wasn't something that people actually wanted to do, to work for the government in this capacity. The draft was somewhat collective. Unlike drafts today, which are commonly based on the individual, the drafts were collective throughout much of history. They would tell the community, we need 1,000 people, give us 1,000 names, or we'll just go and drag out the first 1,000 we see. They didn't particularly care who it was. They would just allocate block grants, kind of. They would just say, we need 1,000 people, give them to us, and that's what we're going to do. The question came up, is it permitted for individuals to pay the authorities or use whatever influence they had so that they would be exempt from this draft? But they knew there was a quota. They knew there was a certain number of people who were needed. So if it wouldn't be them, it would be somebody else. So they were essentially, again, diverting the train. They were pushing harm that otherwise would have fallen on themselves. They were pushing off the harm onto somebody else. So Ibn Lev, or Yosef Ibn Lev, great Turkish Sephardic authority of that time, mid-16th century, he says it depends. if the calamity, if the problem has already landed on your head, you have already been selected, they've already fixed on you, and then you are going to pay them or use whatever influence you have to get yourself out, and you know that will immediately and directly trigger someone else will be taken in your stead, then it actually is prohibited. If, however, they have not yet selected who they want, they've simply said, we need 1,000 people, and before they make the selections, you go into the commander and you say, not me, please, here's $1,000, that is okay. Again, this might sit a little bit uncomfortably with us. You know, we're used to thinking that it's not fair that the rich should be able to do this to the poor. It was certainly, however, this was a common arrangement until relatively recently, throughout the 19th century. You read about the Civil War. They had these riots because of this, where people, even if people were individually drafted, they could pay surrogates to serve in their stead, which ostensibly is fair. We're not discriminating. Anybody who wants could pay a surrogate. Practically, that means the rich are not going to serve, and the poor will serve, even though it's technically, you know, their choice, obviously, to accept surrogate money. It's not their choice if they get drafted and they can't afford a surrogate. But this was a common arrangement in Europe and in the United States for much of history. You saying something? So there actually, we turn now to a few responses about this question that occurred in the 19th century. The 19th century, we had the decrees of the Cantonists, where the Russian government would seize Jewish children for 25-year terms. We're not talking about a draft, you know, 3 years, then the GI Bill, and then healthcare for life, and then the service back then meant cannon fodder, you know, complete assimilation as a 12-year-old in the Russian army for 25 years. And then if you were alive and, you know, whole, you can go back to your community. And the governments, again, besides this being a terrible decree on Jewish communities, what made it vastly worse was the fact that it was often collective, that they wouldn't name, you wouldn't show up to the selective service office, you know, have a number and be selected. They would tell the Jewish community, we need 100 people. This, of course, would pit Jew against Jew. This would create tremendous machlokas, tremendous strife, tremendous, you know, unimaginable bitterness at different factions of the community. The less powerful were often accusing the more powerful, the rabbinate, the rich, the politically connected, of selling them out and giving their children to the draft instead of their own. We actually have, there's a lot that can be studied from the historical record here, but we actually have several responses from the period where rabbinic authorities were asked about what is the right of a parent or of someone to, again, get himself out of the draft if he knows that'll mean that someone else's child will be taken in his stead, or even worse, to simply provide someone else's child to the government instead of himself. So the latter is unequivocally rejected, abominated by those who discuss it. We have a tshuva by Rabbi Moshe Sofer, the great Hungarian authority, who writes in the most stark terms possible, this is absolute, this is egregious and completely intolerable. We have Rabbi Shmuel Landau, the son of Rabbi Yecheskel Landau, the Rabbi Yehuda, also unequivocally rejecting the idea that you can turn in someone else's child to save yourself. However, the more interesting question, or at least the one that they're less certain about, is can you simply use your influence to get yourself off, to get your child off, if that means someone else will be taken in your stead? And here, again, they follow a position similar to that of Ibn Lev 300 years earlier. They argue that it depends. Once they've selected you and you're getting yourself out of the problem and displacing the problem onto somebody else, that is actually prohibited. But if they haven't yet selected you and you're simply saying, I don't want the selection to befall me, that is more lenient, that there is basis for doing that. And again, that's in line with Ibn Lev. It poses an interesting moral dilemma for us. And the Chasam Sofer, Rabbi Moshe Sofer, actually discusses surrogates. He says those who offer themselves as essentially mercenaries, as surrogates for hire, they're willing to serve for you if you pay them, what they're doing is a very bad idea from a Jewish perspective, he says. He says that you can't keep kosher and Shabbos in the army, so a Jew who volunteers for the army when it's not forced upon him is doing the wrong thing. However, he says the government does have the right to draft. Even though they shouldn't be volunteering, if you're drafted, the government is within its legitimate rights, he says, to draft people to its army. And once there are surrogates, they're available, even though they shouldn't be doing it. Ideally, he says, if they're willing to do it, then it's their decision, you should hire them rather than do it yourself. As to actually paying the government, you know, using your influence to get yourself out, that depends on whether they have targeted you or not. And here we get finally, of course, to the Holocaust situations. We have several responses discussing this type of unspeakable dilemma in the Holocaust, where there are cases where the Nazis were rounding up people for execution, rounding up children in some cases, and they had a building full of 200 people, and they had records of how many kids were in the building, and people were bribing the guards to get their kid smuggled out, but they knew that would mean the guards had to make up the quotas. They knew that would mean someone else's kid would be snatched. Obviously, that's an inconceivable, unthinkable dilemma, but nevertheless, it is subject. We're not going to judge anyone, certainly, for whatever they did under such circumstances, but certainly we can conceptually consider what should be done in that case. We actually have responsa by some who make these types of arguments. There's one particularly poignant tale where the Rav relates that he was approached by a simple, God-fearing Jew who said, "My son is in there. I have the money to get him out, but I know it's not so simple under Jewish law, Jewish ethics, as we said. What should I do?" So the rabbi said, "It's a tough question. I don't have my sfarim here. I don't have to be responsible for such a question. It's too much for me." So the fellow said, "All right." He told God, "The rabbi doesn't want to give me an answer. I see it's not a simple question. It might be prohibited, so I'm not going to do it." He said, "Now listen, God. Abraham gave up his son Isaac, and God told him to, and I'm doing the same thing. You can have my son. I can't, if the rabbi can't tell me it's allowed, then I'm not going to do it, and that's it."
Was the direction of the authorities in these, as the czarist communities, aimed at the community leaders? Because often, as you say, the decree was to the community, you pick somebody, and the bribery would be to the community leaders. So were they directing their response to individuals or to the community?
That's a good question. I don't recall whether that point was made sufficiently clear in the two responses in question. You're right that sometimes they were the ones who had the power. I don't remember in these two cases whether that was the... I'm not even sure if both of these were addressed against... The famous one is, as you said, the Russians. These were actually a little bit earlier, the beginning of the 19th century. These might have been other countries in Central Europe. I don't know if the system was the same. So that is an important question, yes. But I'm not going to get too much more deeply into that because I'm just not sure.
Yeah, because it would seem like they would know, when the people who were in power would know, that they would start picking people. The exemptions would be made even before the picking started. They're the ones that would be doing it,
right,
Accepting their own kids.
Yeah. This is true.
The story goes that I've heard is that there were young men who then would leave for the United States around that time. Do you have any knowledge of that? Just, I know it's a quick aside, but do you have any knowledge of that?
I've heard a lot of also stories like that. I've heard of cases of siblings who had different last names sometimes because there would often be an exemption for an only son of a family, so people would change their names. A less drastic step than emigration was often to claim you were an only son or other ways of avoiding the draft. I have heard people fled the country also. I didn't research that type of thing. That there's a lot of, as you said, a lot of history. Yeah, so.
I think it was 1880, I think, with my great-grandfather,
not sure. Right, so I don't know much of the history. I studied it more from the rabbinic legal side, but there is certainly a lot of history. I just don't know much about it, so yes.
Okay.
So the general theme we've seen, and most of these questions have disputes and hinge a lot on the details, and certainly there are questions of process and evidence that we haven't touched, but in general the point is these examples illustrate that Jewish law, Jewish ethics, is very much not a strictly, certainly not a simple-mindedly utilitarian system. We don't simply look at the greatest good for the greatest number. We make all these subtle and kind of legalistic distinctions between has the misfortune befallen, has it not befallen, is he guilty under some system of law, is he not guilty? There are a whole host of values that are in play here. The fact that five people will be saved versus one person in some cases might be the beginning of the discussion, but it is certainly not the end. Jewish law does sometimes say that five people have to die rather than one, because the greatest good for the greatest number is very much not the only consideration that we have to take into account when making these decisions. I want to talk for a while now on living donor organ donation. This is another area, there are a number of issues that come up here, but this is another issue where we can consider some of the same ethical dilemmas, the same ethical systems of weighing values against each other. So we're not going to be discussing posthumous organ donation, things like hearts and that. We're going to be discussing cases where a living donor is going to donate some tissue focus on the case of kidneys, although as Arnie points out, there are other cases. You can donate blood, you can donate tissue and corneas and pieces of liver and so on. Lots of questions, skin. We're going to focus on kidneys because it's a particularly sharp illustration of some of the major Jewish legal and ethical themes that we have to consider in these types of questions. So kidney donation, you know, began half a century ago or so, middle of the last century. They began, we have two kidneys. Apparently you can live pretty well with one. I don't know if anyone knows exactly why we have two. We have two of lots of things. We have two eyes, two arms, two nostrils, two ears. So, you know, systems engineers can talk. We can talk about redundancy. You can talk about how they two work better than one. You know, you can have three-dimensional vision with two eyes. So any given paired organ or paired bodily system, you can come up with different reasons why we have two. Kidneys, in particular, I don't know if there's a clear sense of why we have two. It would be nice to have two hearts. Many people, you know, suffer heart conditions. It would be nice, certainly, to have a redundant heart. For whatever reason, the design of the body apparently allows, it works well to have two kidneys. The function, though, seems to be largely a question of redundancy. Studies, again, you can always study things further, and we don't know everything yet, but studies have shown that when you lose a kidney, you can live a pretty good, pretty similar to an ordinary person life afterward. Again, we're focusing primarily on cases where you are thoroughly screened for good health and for good kidney function. If you did a completely random survey of what happens if you take an arbitrary individual and take out a kidney, the results might be much worse. But certainly after you've passed screening and you're doing really well and everything, which are the only people that take kidneys from in the first place, the morbidity and mortality are quite good when donating a kidney. One of the few lifestyle things I saw they warn you about is take really good care of the next one. If you play contact sports, you wear extra padding and, you know, make sure you don't lose your second one. But beyond that, you know, some studies show a little bit hypertension may be an increase in some conditions, but in general, the risk is quite low. And the question arose in the mid-20th century after the medical establishment began to develop techniques for successfully transplanting kidneys. So is this something that Jewish law allows, requires, thinks is a good idea? So what's the framework in Jewish law for evaluating this type of decision? So the root of this issue goes back to a passage in the Palestinian Talmud, which might be a little bit ambiguous, but primarily it goes back to a responsum of the Radvaz, Rabbi David Ibn Zimra, a 16th century, again, Egyptian, later Israeli, leading Sephardic authority. He was asked about a case. The actual case he's referring to goes back several centuries. It was initially posed in the medieval period by Rabbi Menachem Riconti, an Italian scholar. But he was asked, in his analysis, Ibn Zimra's analysis in the mid-16th century was about a sadistic or cruel ruler, dictator of some sort, who told a Jewish person, give me a limb, allow me to amputate a healthy, functioning limb, an arm or something. If you do not do that, I will kill somebody else. That's your choice. Make a choice. Why the king did this, I have no idea. If this is a real case or a hypothetical case, certainly it was a lot more real and realistic and everyday sounding people who lived in those cruel and backward times. Thank God, you know, we in the first world, at least today, don't experience this very often, but this was apparently the sort of thing that people were concerned with back then. The sadistic ruler wants an arm, and if not, he is going to kill another Jew. Should you do that? So Ibn Zimra establishes a number of rules for making this decision. He says, if your life is going to be in danger, amputating a limb, certainly before modern medicine, certainly before what we understand about sanitation and about cauterization and about, you know, properly treating wounds, certainly would put the donor, so to speak, at considerable risk of his life. Certainly, he says, that is absolutely wrong. You cannot even risk your life, even if it's uncertain, even if it's a 50-50 chance. You cannot even risk your life to save someone else from certain death. Not only don't you have to do that, you're not allowed to do it, and it's the absolutely wrong thing to do. And if you choose to do it, you think you're being pious, you're actually a chassid shota, literally a pious fool, a term of art, a rabbinic jargon for someone who is well-meaning but is making a deeply misguided decision. Absolutely, you're not allowed to do it, and you're wrong for doing it. It's not chassidus, it's not piety. It is actually halachically unacceptable. However, if it is just a question of giving up a limb, but there will be no danger to life, then you are still not obligated to do it. The Radvaz rules can't require you to. However, if you do, it is a midas chasidus. That is a pious act, to give up a limb, to give up some bodily tissue, to save someone else from death. That is something admirable, something commendable. There are those who disagree. There are those who felt that it is actually, you are actually obligated to even risk your life, even to undergo, to accept serious risk, significant risk to your life to save somebody else from death. This is another example of where Jewish ethics is incorporated in the law. Under modern law, there is typically no legal obligation to be a good Samaritan. Good Samaritan is neither modern nor Jewish. It's Christian, but there's generally no obligation to, you see somebody drowning, even if you can jump in and save him without any risk to your own life, you are under no legal obligation to do so. You see somebody lose his wallet, you're under no obligation to pick up the wallet and return it. You can't keep the wallet for yourself, that's theft, but you have no obligation to trouble yourself to find the wallet and return it. However, we know, of course, under Jewish law, both those things are absolute binding obligations. If you find a lost wallet, you absolutely have to return it. That's called Hashavas Aveda, returning lost property. If you see somebody drowning and you can save him, you're a trained lifeguard and you know what you're doing, and there's literally no risk to yourself, you have a binding mandatory obligation to do so. It's included both in Hashavas Aveda. It's an a fortiori argument. If you have to save his property and return his property, you certainly have to save his life and his person. Also, Lo Samar Al Dam Re'echa. There's a prohibition against standing idly by while somebody suffers injury or death. So under Jewish law, if there's no risk to you, you are absolutely obligated to save somebody else's life and property. The question is, of course, well, what about here? Well, there is danger to yourself. There's loss of your own tissue and organ and danger. So there is an opinion that says, doesn't matter. The obligation to save somebody else from certain death overrides and requires you to put yourself even at risk of death to yourself if it's only a suffix for you. This is a very much a consequentialist flavored argument that for you it's only 50% chance of death, for him it's 100% chance of death. If you calculate expected values, obviously what is more likely to bring more life and more happiness to more people is risking your life to save him. There is an opinion that does require that, but that's against the Radvaz. The rabbinic consensus, the Jewish law consensus, strongly follows though that of the Radvaz, the earlier position, that not only don't you have to, you are not even allowed to risk your life to save somebody else, despite the fact that statistically, actuarially, there'll be more life by doing that. It doesn't matter. Again, we are not a utilitarian consequentialist system. Your life takes precedence. It's not even up to you. As in many areas in Jewish law, you do not have supreme authority over your own person. The Torah, Jewish law, has requirements, has actions that it expects of you, and it doesn't matter what you want, you are not allowed to, and you are a chassid shota, a pious fool, if you choose to do so. So the question then is, under this background, this is generally accepted, as I said, the question is, how do we deal with something like a kidney donation? So obviously, trying to apply these kind of general precedents to this type of practical real-world case is going to hinge very much on the facts. What is the risk of a kidney donation? There are two potential sources of risk, of course. There is the risk of the surgery itself. Every surgery carries risk. And then there's the risk of the long-term mortality and morbidity of being down one kidney. So the earliest rabbis, and this is a classic example of the evolution of halacha, the way Jewish law evolves to react to changing circumstances. The law itself, in its abstract nature, doesn't really evolve, but the point is, the practical applications of the law are going to evolve as the circumstances with which they deal evolve. So again, when kidney donation was in its infancy, there were leading Israeli authorities who felt that the risk was too high. Either the risk was simply unknown, or they were believed to be higher, or the technology was primitive enough, the risks were higher. And there are noted responsa from mid-20th century authorities who said that it is wrong to donate a kidney. Eliezer Yehuda Waldenberg, leading Israeli authority, expert on medical halacha in general, Rabbi Yitzchak Weiss, author of the Minchas Yitzchak, another leading, originally English, later Israeli authority, both ruled that the danger is too high, and living donor kidney donation, would therefore be forbidden by Jewish law. Now, it's difficult from their responsa to ascertain how dangerous they understood such donation to actually be. That Rabbi Waldenberg, for example, concedes that insofar he anticipates the fact that technology may advance to a point at which such procedures are much safer, at which point his opposition would have to be revisited. However, based on what he was told, he said at the time, the medical professionals, the risk was too high, and therefore Jewish law would not countenance such an operation. Now, it is a very frustrating point in dealing with these types of issues in that there is no general, consistent, quantifiable level of risk that we can use to apply halachic rules. The halachic authorities typically use very general, very vague qualitative measures. They talk about safek, meaning doubt. They talk about mashu, tiny amount. They use very, very evocative but not very quantifiable terms. So it's very difficult to juxtapose two rulings and decide whether they're in agreement or not. Very, very difficult to generalize a ruling by understanding what exactly is the quantifiable level of risk in this case that was sufficient for him to prohibit the procedure. So it's difficult to know exactly how what risks would be acceptable, what risks would not be acceptable. One of the papers I included here in the handouts by Rabbi Yair Hoffman, he quotes various rabbinic authorities who have tossed around figures, typically on a logarithmic scale, order of magnitude type figures, to decide what types of risks are acceptable, 1 in 1,000, 1 in 10,000. But we don't have really reliable, generally acceptable rules for determining what type of risk is acceptable and what type of risk is not acceptable. Moreover, even risks which would be considered unacceptable in one context sometimes are acceptable in a different context, even in the absence of any life-saving consideration. So, for example, the great classic example often held up by scholars who are analyzing this topic is the question of taking a sea voyage. Not a sea voyage today on the QE2 or something, which is the lap of luxury. We're talking about taking a sea voyage 1,000 years ago where you would typically be taking out piracy insurance and shipwreck insurance, and where the risks were quite high, where the risks of not making it safely were quite high. So the question is, we know that when the Talmud talks about the Gomel blessing, the blessing that you make on being successfully delivered from danger, there are four kind of textbook scenarios that are mentioned by the Talmud. One of them is someone who completes a sea voyage uneventfully. That was considered dangerous enough that you recite the Gomel blessing, you brought a carbon todah, a special Thanksgiving offering when the temple was in operation. Today we recite the Gomel blessing for traversing the sea. Yet, people did, as a matter of discretion, as a matter of choice, choose to take sea voyages, for business, for pleasure even, people did that. So on the one hand, it was considered, the Jewish law recognizes it as being dangerous enough that you owe a particular degree of thanks to God from saving you from danger, yet it is a sort of danger which was often voluntarily adopted, and sometimes even for recreation. There are actually rabbinic authorities who have ruled that you should not be taking sea voyages, at least sea voyages of the danger that was assumed back then, for recreation. Rav Kook, writing 100 years ago, says that the types of things that the Talmud says you recite the Gomel blessing for are not acceptable for purely recreational purposes. That they should only be done for making a living, he says, is a legitimate enough reason to accept upon yourself this limited level of risk. But just for fun, he says, absolutely not. Other authorities take the same position. So the question is, again, when Rav Waldenberg and Rav Weiss, when they ruled some 50, 60 years ago that kidney donation was not acceptable, we don't know exactly what level of risk they were talking about, and they anticipated that it wasn't totally clear. Further research is indicated, and technology might advance, but at least in their time, they were somewhat reluctant to allow kidney donation because they felt it was unacceptably high risk. Now, yes.
Well, what's interesting is even though there's been a lot of advances in technology and medicine, Dr. Error continues to be the third leading cause of death in America.
Right.
So there's still an inherent risk involved in going under the knife.
Yes.
Regardless of how routine the surgery is.
Yes. So I.
Dr. Error.
So I had a relatively minor surgical procedure once. And I asked the doctors point blank. I said, okay, what are the odds of serious complications, death and things of that nature? They said, oh, no, it's very, very low. Don't worry about it. So I pushed them for numbers. They don't like giving numbers to laymen, but occasionally if you push them harder, they'll say, oh, it's like 1 in 5,000 or something. I was not impressed by those odds. 1 in 5,000, that's a big number. People play the lottery for a lot smaller numbers. So people have argued we do a lot of things that involve that level of risk. So if you calculate, for example, the risk of dying in an automobile accident. There are, I don't know, tens of thousands of deaths per year. So any given trip of 3 miles, the odds are quite low. But here you get into another question of aggregate risk. If you travel 20 miles a day for 10 years, 5 days a week, then the odds of dying in a collision get quite high. So,
but it's the do-nothing odds also.
Yeah, you can die by not doing anything. If you're too sedentary, things can happen to you. If you stay, if you never get out, you don't get enough sun, things can happen to you. So, yes.
The surgery is... What are the odds?
Oh, of course, right.
Doing nothing, and what are the odds?
But you're less likely to die from a surgeon if you don't have a surgery.
Yes, but Arnie's point is you have to look at less likely to die overall, not from the surgeon or from the underlying cancer or whatever the condition was. So it depends on the surgery. So we've discussed in other contexts, we've discussed things like cosmetic surgery, and there were authorities who felt that cosmetic surgery, you're not going to die from having a nose that's less straight than you would like, and you may die from the surgery. On the other hand, most medical conditions beyond purely cosmetic surgery, the thing can kill you, even relatively minor things. If it's an untreated hernia, can cause, what's the word for it?
Incarceration,
thank you. Can cause incarceration of the blood vessels. You can cut off circulation, and bad things can happen to you. So most surgeries, again, the point is certainly correct. We're looking at relative risk, not at absolute risk, but even relative risk. There are definitely surgical procedures where certainly cosmetic ones, where the relative risk is non-zero, and yet we do them. So the halakhic authorities don't always give us exact, rigid notions for what's acceptable risk and what's not. In this particular case, despite the Radvaz, despite the consensus I mentioned earlier that says that we don't do even possible risk to save someone else from certain risk, they do draw a qualitative line, if not a quantitative one. They bring from the work called Agudas Azov, who says that, however, don't get too carried away. Real risk, yes, you should not undertake to save somebody else even from definite risk. However, don't think that everything is risk. Don't be such a coward and think that anything, I can't do anything, I can't lift a finger, maybe something's going to go wrong and I'm going to die. At some point, you have to say enough, that the risk is de minimis, the risk is so low and saving a life is so important, you have to do it. And unfortunately, again, we don't have any kind of real applicable yardstick to know when to say the risk is serious and when to say the risk is negligible. But we do find already in early authorities several hundred years ago both sides of the coin. Real risk should not be accepted. De minimis risk should indeed be accepted.
I've heard donating blood. I heard from a very pious rabbi that he was against donating blood. He said your body is God's property.
Yeah.
You don't have to, that doesn't seem to accord with what you're describing.
I'll touch on that. We'll touch on that soon.
And that's the most de minimis.
Right. Absolutely.
Risks.
I'll touch on that in a moment. Just yes.
Somebody has to be off of work for a while they give a donated kidney or something else, their insurance premiums may go up. How does that?
So that's a good question. Economic effects, typically Jewish law would require you to assume. Just as in the case of the person drowning in the river, if you can save him, even if that means missing work, even if that means missing a week of work for some reason, even if that means spending a lot of money, you are obligated generally to spend money to save someone's life. Now, you do have the right to bill him for any costs that you incur,
right,
both actual loss and even opportunity costs, perhaps. You can even bill him for lost opportunity. If you missed an opportunity to make money or you missed work, you could bill. However, you'd still need to do it regardless of the bill, and even if you know he can't pay, you know he's penniless and he won't pay, you generally are still obligated, the consensus is, to save a life. So that's strictly economic costs. Where the question becomes less simple when we work out something in between, which is more serious than economic costs, but not loss of life. It's going to be painful. It's going to cause you to be just bedridden and just uncomfortable for a long time. It's beyond simple economic loss, but it's serious physical discomfort or even loss of functionality. Let's say you would give up the... We'll discuss this a little more in the context of the kidneys in a moment. That's less clear. Just returning to the kidneys, make sure we cover the other opinions. So with regard to kidneys, the consensus of later authorities is that it is permitted. I spent a lot of time discussing the opinions of Rabbi Waldenberg and Rabbi Weiss. The consensus of most later authorities, including Rabbi Avadia Yosef and many others, have said whatever their position was, either we disagree or today the technology has improved. The consensus, certainly, overwhelming consensus of contemporary authorities is that certainly with the advances medical technology have made, and with the ability to select people who are in good health and won't suffer from losing from giving up a kidney, The consensus is generally that it is certainly not forbidden, and that it is commendable. You see many Jewish organizations push it and recommend it and encourage it, and that is the consensus position, that it is permitted and actually praiseworthy. The consensus is still, though, that it is not required, either because there are still some levels of risk which are non-zero, or because at the end of the day, it's your kidney, it's your tissue. As you were mentioning, even with blood, there might be some who say that it's your tissue and that you don't have to give it up. In general, as we said, economic loss you do have to take to save a life. Greater than economic loss is less clear. When the Radvaz was talking about giving up an arm, even if in theory there was no danger, he still understands that we don't require you to give up an arm to save somebody else's life. Again, leaving up an arm is more than just tissue. It's a major loss of functionality, has a major impact on your lifestyle, and so on. Kidney, you can argue, is less serious because it will not have a major impact on your lifestyle. You won't notice for most of your life that it's missing even. It is technically your tissue. Nevertheless, whether the reason is because it is your tissue, whether the reason is because there's still some level of risk, in general, the halakhic authorities do not generally require, to the best of my knowledge, do not generally consider it mandatory. They do, however, generally consider it a good idea, certainly permissible and even praiseworthy. The idea that it's, you know, your body is God's and not yours, that is a halakhic argument. It's usually made with regard to things like giving up your life. Even if you want to, a person's life is not, at the end of the day, you know, personal autonomy over one's body is not absolute in Jewish law. You don't generally have the right to make arbitrary decisions to give up your life. When it comes to mere tissue, though, my understanding is that the consensus is that it is permitted to give up things like blood or even kidneys. As I said, if the consensus is to give up a kidney, I think the consensus would almost certainly be that you can, and it's even praiseworthy, to donate blood if you can save other people from death. You know, there may be outliers, maybe other opinions, maybe a dissenting school that says at the end of your day it's your tissue and you should not give it up even for that. But here I think the consensus is pretty much, which in line, it isn't always in line, but in this type of thing, the consensus I think lines up pretty well with what I think most people would intuitively think is the right answer to this type of moral dilemma. It is permitted, it is commendable, it's even recommended that a person give up tissue, a kidney, blood, or anything else to save somebody's life. We can't actually require you to do it given the fact that there is some risk, albeit not zero. Just one last coda to this, Rabbi Hoffman touches on this briefly in his paper, is the question of selling organs. The law does not like that. The medical establishment consensus does not like the idea that it's illegal generally, I think, to buy and sell organs in the U.S. There are intricate policy arguments that can be made on both sides. The libertarian argument is, economic, libertarian, personal libertarian argument is, more organs, personal autonomy, what's not to like? You make the decision under your own free will, so your call. Other sides argue that it's not for the good of society. If some people are getting paid for it, nobody will want to donate for free. They argue about coercion, the sense of people will be pressured to give organs by family, by others. I was speaking to someone who had been involved at one point in the organ donation process. He told me that they take immense pains to make sure that the donors, prospective donors, suffer no undue pressure. To the extent, he told me that they have separate medical teams working with both sides, donor and recipient, and the donor can walk away at any time, or up to some point. And then they said that they tell the donor, if you want to walk away, we'll tell the other side we found a medical objection to doing it. You don't even have to feel that they're going to be upset and they're going to be looking at you funny if they will make an excuse. So certainly society tries very hard to avoid any pressure. So obviously financial pressure. So on the one hand, where would Jewish law stand on this? There isn't anything significant in traditional Jewish literature on selling organs. On the one hand, Jewish law does, as I've discussed here in our inaugural talk and several times since then, on the one hand, Jewish law does typically have a pretty laissez-faire attitude. When you can't point to a specific prohibition against some kind of transaction, assuming the transaction is by mutual agreement and there's no undue pressure, you can pretty much make any kind of transaction you want. There's generally nothing that stands in the way of freedom of contract. On the other hand, if you could demonstrate that the harm to society, if you can demonstrate convincing, compelling policy reasons why such trade should be banned, we're not dogmatic libertarians. We might accept such a prohibition. Certainly, if that is the law of the land, that takes you into the whole Dina de Malchusa question, the imperative to follow the law. And again, these are topics that are beyond the scope of our talk. But in general, in principle, Jewish law would have no real objection, I don't think, to selling an organ, assuming the underlying donation is okay, the risk to the donor is limited, the value to the recipient is high, and all that. Assuming, as we've said, the consensus position that that is going to be permitted, then the fact that you're being paid for it wouldn't materially change the calculus.